Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents 22 on Peleliu, Four Pacific Campaigns with a Corps, The Memoirs of an Old Breed Marine, by George Pito, with Peter Margaritis. Narrated by Paul Bryan. A note from the co-author. In the late spring of 2015, I decided to enter a U.S. Naval Institute 3,000-word essay contest. The subject was to be any noteworthy U.S. Marine Corps event that had significantly changed American history. This would be a challenge for me, because for over 30 years, although my research specialty has been World War II, I had mainly studied and written about the European theater, so I was getting into somewhat unfamiliar ground. I talked to a couple of American Legion cohorts that were Marine veterans, and their consensus was that I do the essay contest about the controversial invasion of Peleliu in September 1944. A Navy buddy of mine suggested I should consult with an old World War II Marine veteran who lived here in Central Ohio, a fellow named George Pito. He was one of what they called the old breed, and had actually been on the Peleliu operation. I first met with George on June 24, 2015, in a Bob Evans restaurant, not too far from his home on the north side of Columbus. George and I quickly struck up a friendship, and I invited him to co-write the essay with me. We thought that we would make a good team, since I was an experienced writer and researcher, and George had not only actually been there in the thick of it, but had a remarkable memory about his experiences. And as everyone who met him knows, he enjoyed retelling them. Our essay, unfortunately, did not win the contest, so George and I decided to expand our work and turn what we had written into a book. As we continued our research, though, and as he told me more about his past, I listened, fascinated, marveling at his consistent, detailed memory of remarkable things that had happened to him many decades ago. I finally realized that a much better book to write would be about his life. I wanted to, I had to write about him, to preserve his memories for everyone, especially his daughter Nancy, his son George Lee, and his friends. He good-naturedly agreed, and so we were off. One thing I found amazing was that despite the fact that he was 92 years old when I began interviewing him, George's stories did not vary much from one telling to the next, except perhaps for some added detail, and sometimes certain phrases were almost word for word. Another reassuring item was that his accounts on certain events were nearly always backed up by subsequent research on my part. This book is the result. It includes George's exploits as a young boy growing up in a very interesting, long-past period in American history. It follows him in his early career in the Marines, his intensive Pacific campaigns, and his interesting life after the war. I definitely have never met a man who has had as exciting a life as his, and I learned so much from him and our research about war in the Pacific. There are points in the narrative where I have slightly dramatized his memories to give them more depth and to help give a story continuity. They are, however, all backed up by extensive research, and the stories are all absolutely true, written as he told them. I would like to thank a couple people for helping us in our endeavor. To Steve Ebersole for his encouragement and for putting me in touch with this amazing Marine. My heartfelt appreciation to son George Lee Pito for encouraging his father to undertake this project. And to daughter Nancy Pito for her wonderful support. Last, my deep gratitude to my loving wife Mindy, who put up with my weird, idiosyncratic behavior during this time. Peter Margaritis. Introduction. My name is George Pito. I am a World War II veteran. I have been a Marine for over 7 decades, what fellow Marines would refer to as one of the old breed. That means I am one of those ancient guys that joined the Marine Corps as a regular, not a reserve, before the outbreak of World War II. I guess that there are not many of us left today. I read one estimate that stated World War II veterans are dying at the rate of almost 500 a day. Wow. According to statistics, of the 670,000 Marines that served in the war, there are probably only 22,000 still alive today. Of them, only about 1,000 are old breed like me, about 1/6 of 1%. Nearly all the guys who served and fought with me are now deceased, so I guess that makes me a part of a very small group indeed. Sometimes I look back at my time in the Corps and just shake my head and wonder. I served through 32 months of war in the Pacific, and I was never even wounded. Heaven knows I came pretty damn close to it dozens of times, but somehow I survived. Although I did get pounded a few times, and dogs sick a few more. According to the numbers, by rights, I should have actually died many times. Maybe at Cape Gloucester by a sniper. Certainly at Peleliu 12 times, from all the intensive incoming fire we took. Or Okinawa and the many advances that we made across the island. Yet still, somehow, I made it through the war. You know, I find it strangely ironic that thousands of my fellow veterans were wounded in the war, came back, and were decorated for valor. Many, although not nearly enough, were fawned over by the VA, back when the VA was doing its job right. Discharged with pomp and circumstance, and as rightfully considered heroes, have been recognized and honored for decades. Me, I served throughout the entire war, fought in 4 major Pacific campaigns, saw, experienced, and endured horrible things no human being should ever have to go through, and in the end, I was unceremoniously sent back to Great Lakes Naval Training Center, processed out, given a quick handshake, and told, "Thanks a lot." I was given some battle ribbons, and years later, because of the malaria I contracted during the war, eligibility for VA benefits. Nothing else. Well, not for several years. Slowly, over time, though, I have been lucky enough to receive many honors. A couple decades ago, I began to tell schoolchildren in Central Ohio about my experiences, giving them an awareness of what my generation did to ensure the rights and freedoms that we enjoy. I feel good about that. In the many decades since the war, I have been fortunate to continue living an interesting life. I had a long career managing my own store and was happily married for 65 years. I've been told that I can still be obstinate at times. Maybe that is what has allowed me to stay on. Even now, at the ripe old age of 93, I am lucky enough to continue to have an active life. I live with both of my children in my own house, work a modest garden, grow some flowers, occasionally go hunting, I still hand-load my own ammunition, and once in a while, I operate my log splitter for firewood. In the last couple decades, as I talked to kids in school and fellow Marines, I was encouraged by several to record some of the things I lived through. I had written a couple of articles, but nothing substantial. Then in 2015, I met Pete Margaritis, an experienced writer and researcher, and after a couple of interesting conversations, he finally convinced me that perhaps such an endeavor might be interesting for some people to hear. So I guess this work is the result of that. You know, recalling many of these events, I again wonder on how I lived through them. And that includes things that happened to me before and after the war. After going through this book, I can imagine that someone will hear this and think, "Damn, all of that couldn't have happened to him." But it did. Every damn bit of it. The details that follow have been recalled to the best of my ability. These are some of the things that really happened to me. Sergeant George Pito, Service Number 317-040, United States Marine Corps. Chapter 1. Early Life. Neither of my parents was born in the United States. They both immigrated from Hungary. My father was born March 7, 1894, and Mom was born 2 years later. Pop could more or less speak 7 different languages, so for one of his professions, he eventually became an interpreter for Municipal Judge Hunsaker in Akron whenever the accused could not speak English. Even though Pop spent many working days in a courthouse, he was mostly an outdoorsman, and my brothers and I picked up this trait. It was one that would shape a good part of my character. I was the 3rd of 4 children. The oldest was Elizabeth Rose, born 6 years before me on August 25, 1916. She was a somewhat thin brunette with a high forehead. I remember her as being sort of prissy, typical for a female in those days. Next in line was my older brother Alex, born July 25, 1920, in Trenton, New Jersey. A year after Alex was born, our family moved to Akron, Ohio. The next year, on September 18, 1922, I came into the world, born at home, with my mom assisted by a midwife. Soon after, our family settled on a backwoods farm in the Portage Lakes area south of Akron, and on June 2, 1928, when we lived in nearby Barberton, Ohio, younger brother Steve was born. Mom assisted again by a midwife. That's all poor folks like us could afford in those days. My old man had a wild streak in him that in his youth often got him into trouble. Having a motorcycle sure as hell did not help, nor did being an alcoholic. Yeah, as he grew older, he drank like a fish and smoked like a fiend. Luckily, smoking was a bad habit that thankfully none of his sons ever took up, although unfortunately Liz did. In fact, Pop did so many things in his life the wrong way, yet somehow the old man lived to be 92 years old. Pop was a great contractor, quite the entrepreneurial self-employed builder. I mean, of just about anything. I remember in my youth that my brother and I would often go out with him and assist him in building a house, or a garage, or a fireplace or something. Sometimes we dug basements for folks. Whatever we could do to make a buck, we would do. Earlier in his life, my old man had trained to be a cobbler. In later years, on the east side of Akron, he started his own shoe repair store, selling and repairing shoes. Unfortunately, Dad gave up the trade because he was not making much money at it. Also, in his mind, even an expert cobbler was still a lowly profession, not worthy of his own talents. So he decided to give up the store and become a freelance contractor. Mom couldn't talk him out of his decision. In fact, she pretty much could not talk him out of anything. You just could not reason with him, especially when he was drunk. Anyway, Pop pretty much did as he damn well pleased, and he could be one mean old bastard. Once, when I was in grade school, I played hooky a couple times. I was hanging around the swamps with a friend of mine, Bob Reining, who lived down the street. Finally, my teacher, frustrated with me as she often was, gave my sister Elizabeth a note to take home to my parents. Liz brought the note home and gave it to Pop, and he got mad as hell. Determined to catch me in the act, he didn't say a word to me when I came home that afternoon, and nothing happened to me that night. So the next day, unsuspecting, I skipped school again and went down to the canal with Bob to take my beat-up canoe out for a ride. After a while, my father came down along the shore, spotted us, and stood on the bank, watching us idly paddling away, happy as a couple of larks. He did not even yell out my name. He just stood there silent. Finally, I looked up and saw him there glaring, and my heart skipped a beat. With a mean look in his eye, he wiggled his index finger, motioning me to come ashore. Taking a deep breath, we paddled over to the bank and got out of the canoe. Man, oh man, that's when all hell broke loose. He beat the crap out of me going up the bank and all the way back to our house, some 3 blocks away. That did the trick. No more skipping classes. I never missed a day of school after that. I was never easy to convince to do things. And normally, I often did things with little thought of the consequences if they were not hurtful or fatal to anyone. But this lesson took. Boy, did it take. During these years, Alex and I often fished with Dad at Wingfoot Lake. One thing that I vividly remember around 5 years old was seeing all these balloons floating around in the sky. They called them airships, but to me, they were big balloons. Most of them were those shorter blimps, although early on, we once in a while saw one of the huge long dirigibles, like the German Zeppelins. Before World War II started, though, they stopped making those and were just making blimps. But because we lived so close to the Goodyear factory, we could clearly see the Akron blimp building from the lake. In the summer, you could see them flying around. And I swear, Goodyear must have had a blimp named for every month of the year. I just sit there in the boat or along the shore and stare at them. Once in a while, we'd see one of those big long dirigibles, like the Akron or the Macon. They'd glide on by, or sometimes hover near the ground as the ground crews worked to land them. Life on our farm was primitive. We lived in a heavily forested area, with lakes, rivers, and swamps all around us. We were not far from the Ohio Canal, and we always kept a boat there that we used to go fishing or just exploring. We grew over half of our own food, and life as such was basic. For one thing, we had no indoor bathroom, and so going to the head in the wintertime was sometimes rather uncomfortable. Country life like that was sometimes a challenge. For one thing, we had bedbug problems. Not that this was unusual, because back then, everybody in our area had bedbugs. My father, though, was rather effective in controlling them. He just used a torch. It seemed to be an effective technique, and anyway, as poor as we really had no alternatives. Chemicals for that sort of thing were not easily available back then. The only thing that you could buy came in powder form. That stuff was expensive, and anyway, it was not very effective against them. Pop's treatment was unique. Every month or so, he'd take our beds apart, and we would drag them outside. He would then separate the mattresses from the frames. The mattresses were filled with straw, so the remedy was easy. We would remove the old straw and burn it, while Mom boiled the mattress covers. We owned a couple of blowtorches, which were common back then. Each one was about 12 inches high, with a 6-inch round fuel tank. In it, we would put gasoline or kerosene. Then he would pump up the blowtorch, turn on the fuel valve, and light it. With a flame about a foot long, he'd take the torch and go to one corner of the bed frame, where it connected to the springs underneath. He would then go down the line of the bed springs and cook them little critters, and you could hear them sizzle and pop as he did. When he was done, he would then take the bed back inside, and we would be good for another month. Because we lived as primitively as we did, we had to spend a good deal of time outdoors. Pop often took me and my two brothers out hunting for food. Rabbit was a common course for our meals. I had my own first kill when I was 9 years old, and after that, I was never too content indoors. I inevitably became an avid outdoorsman, and so I never really acclimated to indoor activities. School, an indoor activity, was always difficult for me, because I preferred to go roaming through the woods looking for adventure, longing to just go exploring. Often, as a young teenager, I would get a friend to go with me and just take off to see what we could see. I took along any sort of basic road map and kept it in my back pocket. We walked wherever our curiosity took us, sometimes hitchhiking across the state by truck or by train. We sometimes stopped for the night on a hayloft or in a barn, before starting off for home the next day. It was a blast for me, and my curiosity always seemed to lead me to something new. This outdoor nature, of course, had its drawbacks. As a teenager, it made my holding any job difficult. That was a big problem, because back then in the early 30s, jobs were difficult to land. However, I was an excellent hunter, and many was the time I would happily go out hunting with my dad for hours on end. As I grew up, partly because of how we lived, I developed a positive attitude on life, and more often than not, I would not take things as seriously as sometimes the circumstances would dictate. I usually preferred the grin or the chuckle over the frown and the growl, and most of my teenage friends considered me to be more or less a happy-go-lucky fellow. So if someone got serious on me, I would laugh. Over the years, I found that this sort of lighthearted attitude was a double-edged sword. Sometimes it worked in my favor, certainly with the girls. Sometimes, though, it backfired and worked against me, mostly with authority. I remember one time when I was in the second grade. My teacher was this beautiful lady. I thought she was prettier than any gal I had ever seen, and I have to admit, I was smitten by her. We were studying a classic poem, A Tree, by Joyce Kilmer, and in the middle of it, somebody made a smart remark. Our teacher looked up from her book and sternly asked, "Who said that?" The room was dead silent. She glanced around with a scowl and started walking down the aisle looking at everybody. She came to where I was sitting and looked at me. I was smiling. She calmly concluded, "You're the culprit." "No, ma'am, I'm innocent." But she didn't believe me. We went on reading the poem. A little later, one of the boys in the back took a small wad of paper and threw it across the room, lightly hitting her in the back. She whirled around, now angry. The guilty party was openly defying her. "Who threw that paper?" she snarled. Again, none of us said anything. She started walking up and down the rows of desks again, glaring. When she came to me, I just looked up and grinned at her. It had just struck me as being funny, and now I was trying to hide the grin by looking innocent. It backfired. She smacked me hard on the head. I saw stars. By 1928, we had sold our first home and had twice moved away from the development sections. Now we had moved into an area below Akron that was called the Portage Lakes, which included some 8 lakes in the area. Living there, we were right next to the Erie, Ohio Canal. There were several reservoirs in the area that helped supply the canal, so water was always nearby. In one remote area, there was a small dirt lane that went far back and eventually ended in an open area next to a swamp. The older kids used it as a lover's lane. The main road that goes south in that area, State Route 93, is called Manchester Road. We lived on a simple, beat-up farm near Nesmith Lake. We called it Mud Lake, on the north side of Carnegie Avenue, the only crossroads in the area. Back then, the area was open country, with swamps all over the place. There was no civic development, and there were no paved highways, just dirt roads with pylon street markers and some pretty maple trees alongside our road. We got some livestock that we took care of, a horse, some pigs, and even a cow. Our house was next to a swamp, and there was a drainage ditch nearby. Dad and I built a small shelter over it for some ducks I had caught. It was around that time when I became aware of the fact that the old man had become a bootlegger. I remember the time because I was supposed to have started school that year, but I did not. From the time I was born until the time I joined the Marines, we lived on several different farms in South Akron, all in a 5-mile radius. We did not stay too long in any location, and we had to move a good deal, and that was for one good reason. The rent would come due. My old man, unfortunately, seldom paid his bills, and paying the rent was an on-and-off thing for him. He would run up a debt, and then either could not pay or would not pay, so as a result, we sooner or later were forced to move. I grew up making a number of friends. Probably the closest were the Getz brothers. There were 3 of them, just like there were 3 of us Pito brothers. Our 2 trios hung out a lot, often sitting at each other's family dinner tables. We shared most everything and promised that we would always stay in touch. My close buddy was the middle brother, Melvin Forrest Getz. We called him Waddy. The older one was named after their father, Seymour, so we called him Danny. The youngest was Warren. We called him Boise. Waddy was a little over a year older than I was, and the 2 of us got along great. As we grew to be teenagers, he developed a strong muscular physique, one that he often bragged about. He had a right to, because he really was a tough son of a gun, a pretty rugged guy. As he grew older and bolder, he once in a while would go into a bar and start a fight by picking on the biggest guy. Once in a while he would lose and come out bloody and worse for the wear, but he always came out laughing. I guess that I was in my share of brawls too. There was this one guy that I went to school with named Paul Dunlap. One day he started bugging me, ordering me around. I kind of let it go, but the second day he pushed me around, I started getting mad, realizing what was going on. He was just out and out bullying me. The third day he started in on me, I'd had enough, so I let him have it. We started fighting, and after about 5 minutes of trading punches, to my surprise, he started laughing. Me, I was fighting dead serious, but I guess he wasn't. We finally stopped and we made up. We ended up being friends after that. Not good ones, and I never got to where I trusted him, but we respected each other. Yeah, even as kids, we did a lot of fighting back then. Partly because it was rough where we lived, and partly because that was one of the few forms of entertainment that we had. And boxing was not only condoned, it was often encouraged. There used to be carnivals or sporting events where boxing matches were set up, and you could enter for next to nothing to compete for prizes, which sometimes were sponsored by our schools. We used to box a lot back then. Mostly it was for fun and to pass the time, sometimes just to get better at doing it. Remember, boxing was really popular back then, and tickets for a good boxing match would go for good money, just like folks today would pay a lot to see a good basketball game. So we would box at all these different places. There was one place in town that had a bar on the first floor, and upstairs they had a gym. So we would go there and box. We would box at other places, too. A number of grade schools and high schools had a Wiona club, and every Wednesday night, the school would have a dance or a set of boxing matches. Often, we would go and just box. Hell, all you just needed was a pair of gloves and a ring. Or we played basketball. All you needed was some sort of hoop and a ball that bounced. What equipment we didn't have, we improvised. Just like hockey, for instance. For hockey sticks, we'd go down to the canal and find these big bushes growing along the banks. We would each find a thick branch that curved up and went out over the water, and we would cut it off. We would then take these wooden branches, dry them out, and then shape them with our knives into hockey sticks. And for a puck, we'd get an old tin can, put a stone in it, crimp the ends, and then beat it around. That was it. In the spring and summer, we played baseball. Again, just the basics. All you needed was an open field, something that passed for a glove, a bat or a stick, and something that could pass for a baseball or softball. There was this one big field near my house, and there was a path that went right through it. Just about every time I went by, there were a few kids playing on one side or the other. There were never any adults or supervisors, just us kids. We did other things to pass the time. Being around the Portage Lakes and the Ohio Canal, we swam a lot. There was one remote spot that we called the Bab, short for Bare-Assed Beach. It was along the old Ohio Canal, a half mile down and back through the swamps. Most of the time, the swamps kept cars from going down there, so we were safe. On warm days when we had spare time, we would walk over there, yank off our bib overalls, drop them on the bank of the canal, and hit the water. The cops knew what we were doing, but couldn't get down there to catch us and run us out. Except sometimes when the weather had been hot and dry for a while and a car could get down there. So the cops would every now and then sneak down whenever they didn't have to worry about getting stuck and try to catch us. Usually, though, we would see or hear them coming and hide. There were these heavy bushes growing along the bank, and so when the cops came looking for us, we'd hide under the bushes. One time they got wise to us and looking around found our clothes. They grabbed them and then told us to come out, or else they'd take them. After thinking about it a bit, and after they warned us that we would get in more trouble and that they were leaving, we finally sheepishly came out of the water. They then gave us hell, but they didn't take us in. They understood that that was our recreation. There was a lot of stuff that we did as kids, and because we were so poor, we had to do some innovative hillbilly engineering. Luckily, we had a lot of material to work with, even if it was all junk. Sometimes we'd go to the junkyard for things we needed, or find a junk haul someone had dumped. We often salvaged nails out of the boards. You see, back in those days, there were no sophisticated waste management services, especially out in the boonies where I lived, and especially not during the Depression. Often, folks just took their sacks of garbage out to the dumps and just pitched it, along with a lot of other junk they didn't want. So we would get a lot of what we needed to fashion our own stuff. For instance, we used to get a bunch of old bottles and play mumbly peg. Waddy and I often played, but sometimes Waddy's younger brother Warren, about my age, would play with us too. Warren, like his older brother, had a short trigger.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?